This audio program is brought to you courtesy of Audible.com. Audible, audio that speaks to you wherever you are.
A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. Volume 1. The Birth of Britain. By Winston S. Churchill. Read by Christian Rodsker. Preface. It is nearly 20 years ago that I made the arrangements which resulted in this book. At the outbreak of the war, about 500,000 words were duly delivered. Of course, there was still much to be done in proofreading when I went to the Admiralty on September 3, 1939. All this was set aside. During nearly 6 years of war, and an even longer period in which I was occupied with my war memoirs, the book slumbered peacefully. It is only now, when things have quietened down, that I present to the public A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. If there was need for it before, that has certainly not passed away. For the second time in the present century, the British Empire and the United States have stood together facing the perils of war on the largest scale known among men. And since the cannons ceased to fire and the bombs to burst, we've become more conscious of our common duty to the human race. Language, law, and the processes by which we've come into being already afforded a unique foundation for drawing together and portraying a concerted task. I thought when I began that such a unity might well notably influence the destiny of the world. Certainly, I do not feel that the need for this has diminished in any way in the 20 years that have passed. On the contrary, the theme of the work has grown in strength and reality, and human thought is broadened. Vast numbers of people on both sides of the Atlantic and throughout the British Commonwealth of Nations have felt a sense of brotherhood. A new generation is at hand. Many practical steps have been taken which carry us far. Thinking primarily of the English-speaking peoples in no way implies any sense of restriction. It does not mean canalizing the development of world affairs, nor does it prevent the erection of structures like United Europe or other similar groupings which may all find their place in the world organization we've set on foot. It rather helps to invest them with life and truth. There's a growing feeling that the English-speaking peoples might point a finger showing the way if things went right, and could of course defend themselves, so far as any of us have the power, if things went wrong. This book does not seek to rival the works of professional historians. It aims rather to present a personal view on the processes whereby English-speaking peoples throughout the world have achieved their distinctive position and character. I write about the things in our past that appear significant to me, and I do so as one not without some experience of historical and violent events in our own time. I use the term English-speaking peoples because there is no other that applies both to the inhabitants of the British Isles and to those independent nations who derive their beginnings, their speech, and many of their institutions from England, and who now preserve, nourish, and develop them in their own ways. This first volume traces the story of the English-speaking peoples from the earliest times to the eve of the European discovery of the New World. It concludes upon the field of Bosworth, the last battle of the tumultuous English Middle Ages. The year is 1485, and a new dynasty has just mounted the English throne. 7 years later, Columbus landed in the Americas, and from this date, 1492, a new era in the history of mankind takes its beginnings. Our story centres in an island, not widely sundered from the continent, and so tilted that its mountains lie all to the west and north, while south and east is a gently undulating landscape of wooded valleys, open downs, and slow rivers. It is very accessible to the invader, whether he comes in peace or war, as pirate or merchant, conqueror or missionary. Those who dwell there are not insensitive to any shift of power, any change of faith, or even fashion on the mainland, but they give to every practice, every doctrine that comes to it from abroad, its own peculiar turn and imprint. A province of the Roman Empire, cut off and left to sink or swim in the great convulsion of the Dark Ages. reunited to Christendom and almost torn away from it once more by the heathen Dane. Victorious, united but exhausted, yielding almost without resistance to the Norman conqueror. Submerged, it might seem, within the august framework of Catholic feudalism, was yet capable of reappearing with an individuality of its own. Neither its civilization nor speech is quite Latin, nor quite Germanic. It possesses a body of custom which, whatever its ultimate sources may be, folkrite brought from beyond the seas by Danes and by Saxons before them, maxims of civil jurisprudence culled from Roman codes, is being welded into one common law. This is England in the 13th century, the century of Magna Carta and of the First Parliament. As we gaze back into the mists of time, we can very faintly discern the men of the Old Stone Age and the New Stone Age, the builders of the great megalithic monuments, the newcomers from the Rhineland with their beakers and tools of bronze. Standing on a grassy down where Dover now is, and pointing to the valley at his feet, one of them might have said to his grandson, "The sea comes farther up that creek than it did when I was a boy." And the grandson might have lived to watch a flood tide, a roaring swirl of white water sweeping the valley from end to end, carving its grassy sides into steep chalk edges and linking the North Sea with the Channel. No wanderings henceforth of little clans in search of game or food-yielding plants from the plains of France or Belgium to the wooded valleys and downs of southern England. No small ventures in dug-out canoes across narrow inlets at slack water. Those who come now must come in ships, and bold and wary they must be to face and master the Channel fogs and the Channel tides, and all that may lie beyond them. Suddenly, the mist clears. For a moment the island stands in the full light of historic day. In itself, the invasion of Britain by Julius Caesar was an episode that had no sequel. But it showed that the power of Rome and the civilization of the Mediterranean world were not necessarily bounded by the Atlantic coast. Caesar's landing at Deal bridged the chasm which nature had cloven. For a century, while the Roman world was tearing itself to pieces in civil war, or slowly recovering under a new imperial form, Britain remained uneasily poised between isolation and union with the continent, but absorbing, by way of trade and peaceful intercourse, something of the common culture of the West. In the end, Rome gave the word, and the legions sailed. For nearly 400 years, Britain became a Roman province. This considerable period was characterized for a great part of the time by that profound tranquility which leaves little for history to record. It stands forth sedate, luminous, and calm. And what remained? Noble roads, sometimes overgrown with woodland. The stupendous work of the Roman wall, breached and crumbling. Fortresses, market towns, country houses, whose very ruins the next comers contemplated with awe. But of Roman speech, Roman law, Roman institutions, hardly a vestige. Yet we should be mistaken if we therefore suppose that the Roman occupation could be dismissed as an incident without consequence. It had given time for the Christian faith to plant itself. Far in the West, though severed from the world by the broad flood of barbarism, there remained, sorely beset, but defended by its mountains, a tiny Christian realm. British Christianity converted Ireland. From Ireland, the faith recrossed the seas to Scotland. Thus the newcomers were enveloped in the old civilization. While at Rome, men remembered that Britain had been Christian once and might be Christian again. This island world was not wholly cut off from the mainland. The southeast, at all events, kept up a certain intercourse with its Frankish cousins across the Straits, and hence came the Roman missionaries. They brought with them a new set of beliefs, which, with some brief, if obstinate, resistance here and there, were accepted with surprising readiness. They brought a new political order, a church which was to have its own rulers, its own officers, its own assemblies, and make its own laws, all of which had somehow or other to be fitted into the ancient customs of the English people. They planted the seed of a great problem, the problem of church and state, which will grow until 1,000 years later it almost rives the foundations of both asunder. but all this lies in the future. What mattered at the moment was that, with her conversion, England became once more part of the Western world. Very soon English missionaries would be at work on the continent. English pilgrims would be making their way across the Alps to see the wonders of Rome, among them English princes who, their work in this world being done, desired that their bones should rest near the tomb of the apostles. Nor was this all, because the English people now have an institution which overrode all local distinctions of speech or custom or even sovereignty. Whatever dynastic quarrels might go on between the kingdoms, the church was one and indivisible. Its rites are everywhere the same. Its ministers are sacred. The kingdom of Kent may lose its ancient primacy. Northumbria make way for Mercia. But Canterbury and York remain. The contrast is startling between the secular annals of these generations, with their meager and tedious records of forays and slaughter, and the brilliant achievements of the English church. The greatest scholar in Christendom was a Northumbrian monk. The most popular stylist was a West Saxon abbot. The apostle of Germany was Boniface from Devon. The revival of learning in the empire of Charlemagne was directed by Alcuin of York. But this youthful, flourishing, immature civilization lacked any solid military defense. The North was stirring again. From Denmark up the Baltic, up the Norwegian fjords, the pirate galleys were once more pushing forth in search of plunder and of new homes for a crowded people. An island without a fleet, without a sovereign to command its scattered strengths, rich in gold pieces, in cunning metalwork and rare embroideries, all stored in defenceless churches and monasteries, was a prize which the heathen men might think reserved for them whenever they chose to lay their hands on it. Those broad, slow rivers of the English plain invited their galleys into the very heart of the country. And once on land, how were rustics hurriedly summoned from the plough to resist the swift and disciplined march of armed bands, mounted or on foot? When the storm broke, the north, the midlands, the east, went down under its fury. If Wessex had succumbed, all would have been lost. Gradually, however, it became manifest that the invaders had come not only to ravage, but to settle. At last, the hurricane abated, and men could take count of their losses. A broad strip of land along the middle of the eastern coast and stretching inland as far as Derby was in Danish hands. Seafarers turned farmers were still holding together as an army. But London, already one of the great ports of northern Europe, had been saved, and all the south. And here was the seat and strength of the royal house. The tie with the mainland had not been severed. Year by year, sometimes by treaty, sometimes by hard fighting, King Alfred's dynasty labored to establish its ascendancy and reunite the land. So successful were they that the temporary substitution of a Danish for an English king made little mark on history. He, too, was a Christian. He, too, made the pilgrimage to Rome. After this brief interlude, the old line returned to the throne, and might have remained there from one generation to another. Yet in three short winter months, between October and Christmas Day in 1066, the astounding event had happened. The ruler of one French province, and that not the largest or most powerful, had crossed the Channel and made himself King of England. The structure into which the Norman enters with a strong hand was a kingdom, acknowledged by all who spoke the king's English, and claiming some vague sovereignty over the Welsh and Scots as well. It was governed, we may say, by the king in council, and the council consisted of his wise men, laymen and clerics. In other words, bishops and abbots, great landowners, officers of the household. In all this, it departed in no way from the common pattern of all kingdoms which had been built out of fragments of the Roman Empire. It had also been showing, since the last of the strong kings died, a dangerous tendency to split up into provinces or earldoms at the expense of the crown and the unity of the nation. A tendency only, because the notion still persisted that the kingdom was one and indivisible, and the king's peace was over all men alike. Within this peace, man was bound to man by a most intricate network of rights and duties, which might vary almost indefinitely from shire to shire, and even from village to village. But on the whole, the English doctrine was that a free man might choose his lord, following him in war, working for him in peace, and in return, the lord must protect him against encroaching neighbours and back him in the courts of law. What is more, the man might go from one lord to another and hold his land from his new lord. And these lords, taken together, were the ruling class. The greatest of them, as we have seen, sat in the king's council. The lesser of them are the local magnates, who took the lead in shire or hundred. And when the free men met in the shire or hundred court to decide the rights and wrongs of a matter, it was their voice which carried weight. We cannot yet speak of a nobility and gentry, because the Saxons distinguished sharply between nobles and peasants, and there was no room for any middle rank. But there were the makings of a gentry to be realized hereafter. Such was the state of England when the new Norman order was imposed on it. The conqueror succeeded to all the rights of the old kings, but his council now is mainly French-born and French-speaking. The tendency to provincialization is arrested. The king's peace is everywhere. But the shifting pattern of relationships is drastically simplified to suit the more advanced, or more logical, Norman doctrine, that the tie of man to lord is not only moral and legal, but material, so that the status of every man can be fixed by the land he owns and the services he does for it if he's a tenant, or can demand if he is a lord. In Norman days, far more definitely than in Saxon, the governing class is a landowning class. In spite of its violent reannexation to the continent and its merger in the common feudalism of the West, England retained a positive individuality, expressed in institutions gradually shaped in the 500 or 600 years that had passed since its severance, and predestined to a most remarkable development. The old English nobility of office made way for the Norman nobility of faith and landed wealth. The lesser folk throve in a peaceful but busy obscurity, in which English and Norman soon blended, and from them will issue in due course the grand jurors, the justices of the peace, the knights of the shire, ultimately overshadowing in power, if not in dignity, the nobility, and even the crown itself. These days are far off. In the meantime, we may picture the government of England in the reign of Henry II, a strong monarchy, reaching by means of its judges and sheriffs into every corner of the land, a powerful church that has come to a settlement with the crown in which the rights of both sides are acknowledged, a rich and self-willed nobility, which the crown is bound by custom to consult in all matters of state, a larger body of gentry, by whom the local administration is carried on, and the king's household, his personal staff, of men experienced in the law and in finance. To these we must add the boroughs, which are growing in wealth and consequence now that the peace is well kept, the roads and seaways safe, and trade is flourishing. Standing at this point and peering forward into the future, we see how much depends on the personality of the sovereign. In the period after the conquest, we've had three powerful rulers. In William, a ruthless and determined soldier prince who stamped the Norman pattern on the land. In his son, Henry I, a far-sighted, patient administrator. In Henry's grandson, the second Henry, a great statesman who'd seen that national unity and the power of the crown hung together, and that both could only be served by offering for a price even justice to all men and enforcing it by the royal authority. Certain strains are developing in that compact fabric of Plantagenet England. The crown is pressing rather hard on the nobility. The king's household is beginning to oust the ancient councillors of the kingdom. We need a strong king who will maintain the law, but a just king who will maintain it not only for his private emolument or aggrandizement, but for the good of all. With King John, we enter on a century of political experiment. Anyone who has heard from childhood of Magna Carta, who has read with what interest and reverence one copy of it was lately received in New York, and takes it up for the first time, will be strangely disappointed, and may find himself agreeing with the historian who proposed to translate its title not as the Great Charter of Liberties, but the Long List of Privileges. Privileges of the nobility at the expense of the state. The reason is that our notion of law is wholly different from that of our ancestors. We think of it as something constantly changing to meet new circumstances. We reproach a government if it is slow to pass new legislation. In the Middle Ages, circumstances changed very gradually. The pattern of society was settled by custom or divine decree, and men thought of the law rather as a fixed standard by which rights and duties could, in case of wrongdoing or dispute, be enforced or determined. The Great Charter, therefore, is not, in our sense of the word, a legislative or constitutional instrument. It is an agreed statement of what the law is, as between the king and his barons, and many of the provisions which seem to us to be trifling and technical indicate the points at which the king had encroached on their ancient rights. Perhaps, in their turn, the victorious barons encroached unduly on the rights of the crown. No one at the time regarded the charter as a final settlement of all outstanding issues, and its importance lay not in details, but in the broad affirmation of the principle that there is a law to which the crown itself is subject. Rex non debet esse sub homine, sed sub Deo et lege. The king should not be below man, but below God and the law. This, at least, is clear. He has his sphere of action, within which he is free from human control. If he steps outside it, he must be brought back. And he will step outside it if, ignoring the ancient council of the kingdom and refusing to take the advice of his wise men, he tries to govern through his household, his favourites, or his clerks. In other words, personal government, with all its latent possibilities of oppression and caprice, is not to be endured. But it is not easy to prevent. The king is strong, far stronger than any great lord, and stronger than most combinations of great lords. If the crown is to be kept within its due limits, some broader basis of resistance must be found than the ancient privileges of the nobility. About this time, in the middle of the 13th century, we begin to have a new word, Parliament. It bears a very vague meaning, and most of those who first used it would have been startled if they could have foreseen what it would someday come to signify. But gradually the idea spreads that if it is not enough for the king to talk things over with his own council, so on the other hand, it is not enough for the barons to insist solely on their right to be considered the council of the kingdom. Though they often claim to speak for the community of the realm, in fact they only represent themselves. And the king, after all, represents the whole people. Then, why not call in the lesser gentry and the burgesses? They are always used in local matters, why not use them in national concerns? Bring them up to Westminster. Two gentlemen from every shire, two tradesmen from every borough. What exactly they are to do when they get there, no one quite knows. Perhaps to listen while their betters speak, to let them know what the grievances of the country are, to talk things over with one another behind the scenes, to learn what the king's intentions are in Scotland and France, and to pay the more cheerfully for knowing. It is a very delicate plant, this Parliament. There's nothing inevitable about its growth, and it might have been dropped as an experiment not worth going on with. But it took root. In two or three generations, a prudent statesman would no more think of governing England without a Parliament than without a king. The actual powers of Parliament would be very hard to define. Broadly, its consent is necessary to give legal sanction to any substantial act of authority. An important change of ancient custom can only be effected by an act of Parliament. A new tax can only be levied with the approval of the Commons. What more it can do, the unfolding of time will show. But its authority is stabilized by a series of accidents. Edward III needed money for his French wars. Henry IV needed support for his seizure of the crown. And in the Wars of the Roses, both the contending parties wanted some sort of public sanction for their actions, which only Parliament could provide. Thus, when in the 15th century the baronial structure perished in faction and civil war, there remained not only the crown, but the crown in Parliament, now clearly shaped into its two divisions, the lords, sitting in their own right, and the commoners as representatives of the shires and boroughs. So far nothing had changed. But the destruction of the old nobility in battle, or on the morrow of battle, was to tip the balance of the two houses, and the commons, knights and burgesses, stood for those elements in society which suffered most from anarchy and profited most by strong government. There was a natural alliance between the crown and the commons. The commons had little objection to the crown extending its prerogative at the expense of the nobility, planting councils of the north and councils of Wales, or in the Star Chamber exercising a remedial jurisdiction by which the small man could be defended against the great. On the other hand, the crown was willing enough to leave local administration to the justices of the peace, whose interest it was to be loyal, to put down sturdy beggars, and to grow quietly and peacefully rich. As late as 1937, the coronation service proclaimed the ideal of Tudor government in praying that the sovereign may be blessed with a loyal nobility, a dutiful gentry, and an honest, peaceable, and obedient commonalty. Thus, by the end of the 15th century, the main characteristics and institutions of the race had taken shape. The rough German dialects of the Anglo-Saxon invaders had been modified before the Norman conquest by the passage of time and the influence of Church Latin. Vocabularies had been extended by many words of British and Danish root. This broadening and smoothing process was greatly hastened by the introduction into the islands of Norman French, and the assimilation of the two languages went on apace. Writings survive from the early 13th century, which the ordinary man of today would recognize as a form of English, even if he could not wholly understand them. By the end of the 14th century, the century of Geoffrey Chaucer, it's thought that even the great magnates had ceased to use French as their principal language, and commonly spoke English. Language, moreover, was not the only institution which had achieved a distinctively English character. Unlike the remainder of Western Europe, which still retains the imprint and tradition of Roman law and the Roman system of government, the English-speaking peoples had at the close of the period covered by this volume achieved a body of legal and what might almost be called democratic principles, which survived the upheavals and onslaughts of the French and Spanish empires. Parliament, trial by jury, local government by local citizens, and even the beginnings of a free press may be discerned, at any rate in primitive form, by the time Christopher Columbus set sail for the American continent. Every nation, or group of nations, has its own tale to tell. Knowledge of the trials and struggles is necessary to all who would comprehend the problems, perils, challenges, and opportunities which confront us today. It is not intended to stir a new spirit of mastery, or create a mood in the study of history which would favour national ambition at the expense of world peace. It may be, indeed, that an inner selective power may lead to the continuous broadening of our thought. It is in the hope that contemplation of the trials and tribulations of our forefathers may not only fortify the English-speaking peoples of today, but also play some small part in uniting the whole world, that I present this account. Winston S. Churchill, Chartwell, Westerham, Kent. January the 15th, 1956. Book 1. The Island Race. Chapter 1. Britannia. In the summer of the Roman year, 699, now described as the year 55 before the birth of Christ, the proconsul of Gaul, Gaius Julius Caesar, turned his gaze upon Britain. In the midst of his wars in Germany and in Gaul, he became conscious of this heavy island which stirred his ambitions and already obstructed his designs. He knew that it was inhabited by the same type of tribesmen who'd confronted the Roman arms in Germany, Gaul, and Spain. The islanders had helped the local tribes in the late campaigns along the northern coast of Gaul. They were the same Celtic stock, somewhat intensified by insular life. British volunteers had shared the defeat of the Veneti on the coasts of Brittany in the previous year. Refugees from momentarily conquered Gaul were welcomed and sheltered in Britannia. To Caesar, the island now presented itself as an integral part of his task of subjugating the northern barbarians to the rule and system of Rome. The land not covered by forest or marsh was verdant and fertile. The climate, though far from genial, was equable and healthy. The natives, though uncouth, had a certain value as slaves for rougher work on the land, in mines, and even about the house. There was talk of a pearl fishery, and also of gold. Even if there was not time for a campaign that season, Caesar thought it would be of great advantage to him merely to visit the island, to see what its inhabitants were like, and to make himself acquainted with the lie of the land, the harbours, and the landing places. Of all this, the Gauls knew next to nothing. Other reasons added their weight. Caesar's colleague in the triumvirate, Crassus, had excited the imagination of the Roman Senate and people by his spirited march towards Mesopotamia. Here, at the other end of the known world, was an enterprise equally audacious. The Romans hated and feared the sea. By a supreme effort of survival, they had 200 years before surpassed Carthage upon its own element in the Mediterranean. But the idea of Roman legions landing in the remote, unknown, fabulous island of the vast ocean of the north would create a novel thrill and topic in all ranks of Roman society. Moreover, Britannia was the prime centre of the Druidical religion, which, in various forms and degrees, influenced profoundly the life of Gaul and Germany. "Those who want to make a study of the subject," wrote Caesar, "generally go to Britain for the purpose." The unnatural principle of human sacrifice was carried by the British Druids to a ruthless pitch. The mysterious priesthoods of the forests bound themselves and their votaries together by the most deadly sacrament that men can take. Here, perhaps, upon these wooden altars of a sullen island, there lay one of the secrets, awful, inflaming, unifying, of the tribes of Gaul. And whence did this somber custom come? Was it perhaps part of the message which Carthage had given to the Western world before the Roman legions had strangled it at its source? Here, then, was the largest issue. Caesar's vision pierced the centuries, and where he conquered, civilization dwelt. Thus, in this summer, 55 years before the birth of Christ, he withdrew his army from Germany, broke down his massive and ingenious timber bridge across the Rhine above Koblenz, and throughout July marched westward by long strides towards the Gallic shore, somewhere about the modern Calais and Boulogne. Caesar saw the Britons as a tougher and coarser branch of the Celtic tribes whom he was subduing in Gaul. With an army of 10 legions, less than 50,000 soldiers, he was striving against a brave, warlike race which certainly comprised 500,000 fighting men. On his other flank were the Germans, driven westward by pressure from the east. His policy towards them was to hurl their invading yet fleeing hordes into the Rhine whenever they intruded beyond it. Although all war was then on both sides waged only with tempered iron, and mastery depended upon discipline and generalship alone, Caesar felt himself and his soldiers not unequal to these prodigies. A raid upon Britannia seemed but a minor addition to his toils and risks. But at the seashore, new problems arose. There were tides unknown in the Mediterranean. Storms beat more often and more fiercely on the coasts. The Roman galleys and their captains were in contact with the violence of the northern sea. Only a year before, they had, at remarkable odds, destroyed the fleet of the hardy, maritime Veneti. With sickles at the end of long poles, they'd cut the ropes and halyards of their fine sailing ships and slaughtered their crews with boarding parties. They'd gained command of the narrow seas which separated Britannia from the mainland. The salt water was now a path and not a barrier. Apart from the accidents of weather and the tides and currents, about which he admits he could not obtain trustworthy information, Julius Caesar saw no difficulty in invading the island. There was not then that far-off line of storm-beaten ships which about 2,000 years later stood between the great Corsican conqueror and the dominion of the world. All that mattered was to choose a good day in the fine August weather, throw a few legions onto the nearest shore, and see what there was in this strange island after all. While Caesar marched from the Rhine across northern Gaul, perhaps through Reims and Amiens to the coast, he sent an officer in a warship to spy out the island shore. And when he arrived near what is now Boulogne, or perhaps the mouth of the Somme, this captain was at hand with other knowledgeable persons, traders, Celtic princes, and British traitors, to greet him. He'd concentrated the forces which had beaten the Veneti in two ports or inlets nearest to Britannia, and now he awaited a suitable day for the descent. What was, in fact, this island which now, for the first time in coherent history, was to be linked with the great world? We have dug up in the present age from the gravel of Swanscombe a human skull which is certainly a quarter of a million years old. Biologists perceive important differences from the heads that hold our brains today. But there's no reason to suppose that this remote Paleolithic ancestor was not capable of all the crimes, follies, and infirmities definitely associated with mankind. Evidently, for prolonged, almost motionless periods, men and women, naked or wrapped in the skins of animals, prowled about the primeval forests and plashed through wide marshes, hunting each other and other wild beasts, cheered, as the historian Trevelyan finally says, by the songs of innumerable birds. It is said that the whole of southern Britain could in this period support upon its game no more than 700 families. Here indeed were the lords of creation. 700 families, all this fine estate, and no work but sport and fighting. Already man had found out that a flint was better than a fist. His descendants would burrow deep in the chalk and gravel for battle-axe flints of the best size and quality, and gain survival thereby. But so far, he'd only learned to chip his flints into rough tools. At the close of the Ice Age, changes in climate brought about the collapse of the hunting civilizations of old Stone Age man, and after a very long period of time, the tides of invasion brought Neolithic culture into the western forests. The newcomers had a primitive agriculture. They scratched the soil and sowed the seeds of edible grasses. They made pits or burrows, which they gradually filled with the refuse of generations, and they clustered together for greater safety. Presently they constructed earthwork enclosures on the hilltops, into which they drove their cattle at night time. Windmill Hill, near Avebury, illustrates the efforts of these primitive engineers to provide for the protection of herds and men. Moreover, Neolithic man had developed a means of polishing his flints into perfect shape for killing. This betokened a great advance, but others were in prospect. It seems that at this time the whole of Western Europe was inhabited by a race of long-headed men, varying somewhat in appearance and especially in colouring, since they were probably always fairer in the north and darker in the south, but in most respects substantially alike. Into this area of long-headed population there was driven a wedge of round-headed immigrants from the east, known to anthropologists as the Alpine race. Most of the people that have invaded Britain have belonged to the Western European long-headed stock, and have therefore borne a general resemblance to the people already living there. And consequently, in spite of the diversities among these various newcomers, the tendency in Britain has been towards the establishment and maintenance of a tolerably uniform, long-headed type. A great majority of the skulls found in Britain, of whatever age, are of the long or medium-headed varieties. Nevertheless, it's known that the Beaker people, and other round-headed types, penetrated here and there, and established themselves as a definite element. Cremation, almost universal in the later Bronze Age, has destroyed all records of the blending of the long-headed and round-headed types of man. But undoubtedly, both persisted, and from later traces, when in Roman times burials were resumed instead of cremation, anthropologists of the older school profess themselves able to discern a characteristic Roman-British type. Although, in point of fact, this may have established itself long before the Roman conquest. Increasing knowledge has rendered these early categories less certain. In early days, Britain was part of the continent. A wide plain joined England and Holland, in which the Thames and the Rhine met together and poured their waters northward. In some slight movement of the Earth's surface, this plane sank a few hundred feet and admitted the ocean to the North Sea and the Baltic. Another tremor, important for our story, sundered the cliffs of Dover from those of Cap Grisnez, and the scour of the ocean and its tides made the Straits of Dover and the English Channel. When did this tremendous severance occur? Until lately, geologists would have assigned it to periods far beyond Neolithic man. But the study of striped clays, the deposits of Norwegian glaciers, shows layer by layer and year by year what the weather was like, and modern science has found other methods of counting the centuries. From these and other indications, time and climate scales have been framed, which cover with tolerable accuracy many thousand years of prehistoric time. These scales enable times to be fixed when, through milder conditions, the oak succeeded the pine in British forests, and the fossilized vegetation elaborates the tale. Trawlers bring up in their nets fragments of trees from the bottom of the North Sea. And these, when fitted into the climatic scale, show that oaks were growing on what is now 60 fathoms deep of stormy water, less than 9,000 years ago. Britain was still little more than a promontory of Europe, or divided from it by a narrow tide race which has gradually enlarged into the Straits of Dover, when the pyramids were a-building, and when learned Egyptians were laboriously exploring the ancient ruins of Saqqara. While what is now our island was still joined to the continent, another great improvement was made in human methods of destruction. Copper and tin were discovered and worried out of the earth. The one too soft and the other too brittle for the main purpose, but blended by human genius, they opened the age of bronze. Other things being equal, the men with bronze could beat the men with flints. The discovery was hailed, and the Bronze Age began. The invasion, or rather infiltration, of bronze weapons and tools from the continent was spread over many centuries, and it is only when 20 or 30 generations have passed that any notable change can be discerned. Professor Collingwood has drawn us a picture of what is called the Late Bronze Age. Britain, he says, as a whole was a backward country by comparison with the continent. Primitive in its civilization, stagnant and passive in its life, and receiving most of what progress it enjoyed through invasion and importation from overseas. Its people lived either in isolated farms or in hut villages, situated for the most part on the gravel of riverbanks, or the light upland soils such as the chalk downs or oolite plateau, which by that time had been to a great extent cleared of their native scrub. Each settlement was surrounded by small fields, tilled either with a footplough of the type still used not long ago by Hebridean crofters, or else at best with a light ox-drawn plough which scratched the soil without turning the sod. The dead were burnt, and their ashes, preserved in urns, buried in regular cemeteries. Thus the land was inhabited by a stable and industrious peasant population, living by agriculture and the keeping of livestock, augmented, no doubt, by hunting and fishing. They made rude pottery without a wheel, and still used flint for such things as arrowheads. But they were visited by itinerant bronze founders, able to make swords, spears, socketed axes, and many other types of implement and utensil, such as sickles, carpenter's tools, metal parts of wheeled vehicles, buckets and cauldrons. Judging by the absence of towns and the scarcity of anything like true fortification, these people were little organized for warfare, and their political life was simple and undeveloped, though there was certainly a distinction between rich and poor, since many kinds of metal objects belonging to the period imply a considerable degree of wealth and luxury. The Late Bronze Age in the southern part of Britain, according to most authorities, began about 1000 BC, and lasted until about 400 BC. At this point, the march of invention brought a new factor upon the scene. Iron was dug and forged. Men armed with iron entered Britain from the continent and killed the men of bronze. At this point, we can plainly recognize across the vanished millenniums a fellow being. A biped capable of slaying another with iron is evidently, to modern eyes, a man and a brother. It cannot be doubted that for smashing skulls, whether long-headed or round, iron is best. The Iron Age overlapped the Bronze. It brought with it a keener and higher form of society, but it impinged only very gradually upon the existing population, and their customs, formed by immemorial routine, were changed only slowly and piecemeal. Certainly, bronze implements remained in use, particularly in northern Britain until the last century before Christ. The impact of iron upon bronze was at work in our island before Julius Caesar cast his eyes upon it. After about 500 BC, successive invasions from the mainland gradually modified the whole of the southern parts of the island. In general, says Professor Collingwood, settlements yielding the pottery, characteristic of this culture, occur all over the southeast, from Kent to the Cotswolds and the Wash. Many of these settlements indicate a mode of life not perceptibly differing from that of their late Bronze Age background. They are farms or villages, often undefended, lying among their little fields on river gravels or light upland soils, mostly cremating their dead, storing their grain in underground pits, and grinding it with primitive querns not yet made with the upper stone revolving upon the lower, keeping oxen, sheep, goats and pigs, still using bronze and even flint implements, and possessing very little iron, but indicating their date by a change in the style of their pottery, which, however, is still made without the wheel. The Iron Age immigrations brought with them a revival of the hilltop camps, which had ceased to be constructed since the Neolithic Age. During the 3rd and 4th centuries before Christ, a large number of these were built in the inhabited parts of our island. They consisted of a single rampart, sometimes of stone, but usually an earthwork revetted with timber and protected by a single ditch. The size of the ramparts was generally not very great. The entrances were simply designed, though archaeological excavation has in some instances revealed the remains of wooden guard rooms. These camps were not mere places of refuge. Often they were settlements containing private dwellings and permanently inhabited. They do not seem to have served the purpose of strongholds for invaders in enemy land. On the contrary, they appear to have come into existence gradually as the Iron Age newcomers multiplied and developed a tribal system from which tribal wars presently arose. The last of the successive waves of Celtic inroad and supersession which marked the Iron Age came in the early part of the 1st century BC. The Belgic tribes arrived in Kent and spread over Essex, Hertfordshire and parts of Oxfordshire, while other groups of the same stock later spread over Hampshire, Wiltshire, and Dorset and parts of Sussex. There's no doubt that the Belgae were by far the most enlightened invaders who had hitherto penetrated the recesses of the island. They were a people of chariots and horsemen. They were less addicted to the hill forts in which the existing inhabitants put their trust. They built new towns in the valleys, sometimes even below the hilltop on which the old fort had stood. They introduced, for the first time, a coinage of silver and copper. They established themselves as a tribal aristocracy in Britain, subjugating the older stock. In the east they built Wheathampstead, Werulam, St. Albans, and Cameledunum, Colchester. In the south, Caleva, Silchester, and Venter Belgarum, Winchester. They were closely akin to the inhabitants of Gaul from whom they had sprung. This active, alert, conquering and ruling race established themselves wherever they went with ease and celerity, and might have looked forward to a long dominion. But the tramp of the legions had followed hard behind them, and they must soon defend the prize they'd won against still better men and higher systems of government and war. Meanwhile, in Rome, at the centre and summit, only vague ideas prevailed about the Western Islands. The earliest geographers believed that the ocean stream encircled the whole earth and knew of no islands in it. Herodotus, about 445 BC, had heard of the tin of mysterious islands in the far west, which he called the Cassiterides, but he cautiously treated them as being in the realms of fable. However, in the middle of the 4th century BC, Pythias of Marseille, surely one of the greatest explorers in history, made two voyages in which he actually circumnavigated the British Isles. He proclaimed the existence of the Prytanic Islands Albion and Ierne, as Aristotle had called them. Pytheas was treated as a storyteller, and his discoveries were admired only after the world he lived in had long passed away. But even in the 3rd century BC, the Romans had a definite conception of three large islands, Albion, Ierne, and Thule, Iceland. Here, all was strange and monstrous. These were the ultimate fringes of the world. Still, there was the tin trade, in which important interests were concerned, and Polybius, writing about 140 BC, shows that this aspect at least had been fully discussed by commercial writers. We are much better informed upon these matters than was Caesar when he set out from Boulogne. Here are some of the impressions he had collected. The interior of Britain is inhabited by people who claim, on the strength of an oral tradition, to be aboriginal. The coast, by Belgic immigrants who came to plunder and make war, nearly all of them retaining the names of the tribes from which they originated, and later settled down to till the soil. The population is exceedingly large, the ground thickly studded with homesteads closely resembling those of the Gauls, and the cattle very numerous. For money they use either bronze or gold coins, or iron ingots of fixed weights. Tin is found inland, and small quantities of iron near the coast. The copper that they use is imported. There is timber of every kind, as in Gaul, except beech and fir. Hares, fowl, and geese they think it unlawful to eat, but rear them for pleasure and amusement. The climate is more temperate than in Gaul, the cold being less severe. By far the most civilized inhabitants are those living in Kent, a purely maritime district, whose way of life differs little from that of the Gauls. Most of the tribes in the interior do not grow corn, but live on milk and meat and wear skins. All the Britons dye their bodies with woad, which produces a blue colour, and this gives them a more terrifying appearance in battle. They wear their hair long and shave the whole of their bodies except the head and the upper lip. Wives are shared between groups of 10 or 12 men, especially between brothers and between fathers and sons. But the offspring of these unions are counted as the children of the man with whom a particular woman cohabited first. Late in August 55 BC, Caesar sailed with 80 transports and 2 legions at midnight, and with the morning light saw the white cliffs of Dover crowned with armed men. He judged the place quite unsuitable for landing, since it was possible to throw missiles from the cliffs onto the shore. He therefore anchored till the turn of the tide, sailed 7 miles farther, and descended upon Albion on the low, shelving beach between Deal and Walmer. But the Britons, observing these movements, kept pace along the coast and were found ready to meet him. There followed a scene upon which the eye of history has rested. The islanders, with their chariots and horsemen, advanced into the surf to meet the invader. Caesar's transports and warships grounded in deeper water. The legionaries, uncertain of the depth, hesitated in the face of the shower of javelins and stones. But the eagle-bearer of the 10th Legion plunged into the waves with the sacred emblem, and Caesar brought his warships with their catapults and arrow fire upon the British flank. The Romans, thus encouraged and sustained, leapt from their ships and, forming as best they could, waded towards the enemy. There was a short, ferocious fight amid the waves, but the Romans reached the shore and, once arrayed, forced the Britons to flight. Caesar's landing, however, was only the first of his troubles. His cavalry, in 18 transports, which had started 3 days later, arrived in sight of the camp, but, caught by a sudden gale, drifted far down the channel and were thankful to regain the continent. The high tide of the full moon, which Caesar had not understood, wrought grievous damage to his fleet at anchor. A number of ships, he says, were shattered, and the rest, having lost their cables, anchors, and the remainder of their tackle, were unusable, which naturally threw the whole army into great consternation. For they had no other vessels in which they could return, nor any materials for repairing the fleet. And since it had been generally understood that they were to return to Gaul for the winter, they had not provided themselves with a stock of grain for wintering in Britain. The Britons had sued for peace after the battle on the beach, But now that they saw the plight of their assailants, their hopes revived and they broke off the negotiations. In great numbers, they attacked the Roman foragers. But the legion concerned had not neglected precautions, and discipline and armour once again told their tale. It shows how much food there was in the island that two legions could live for a fortnight off the cornfields close to their camp. The British submitted. Their conqueror imposed only nominal terms. Breaking up many of his ships to repair the rest, he was glad to return with some hostages and captives to the mainland. He never even pretended that his expedition had been a success. To supersede the record of it, he came again the next year, this time with 5 legions and some cavalry conveyed in 800 ships. The islanders were overawed by the size of the armada. The landing was unimpeded, but again the sea assailed him. Caesar had marched 12 miles into the interior when he was recalled by the news that a great storm had shattered or damaged a large portion of his fleet. He was forced to spend 10 days in hauling all his ships onto the shore and in fortifying the camp of which they then formed part. This done, he renewed his invasion and, after easily destroying the forest stockades in which the British sheltered, crossed the Thames near Brentford. But the British had found a leader in the chief Cassivellaunus, who was a master of war under the prevailing conditions. Dismissing to their homes the mass of untrained foot soldiers and peasantry, he kept pace with the invaders march by march with his chariots and horsemen. Caesar gives a detailed description of the chariot fighting. In chariot fighting, the Britons begin by driving all over the field hurling javelins, and generally the terror inspired by the horses and the noise of the wheels are sufficient to throw their opponents' ranks into disorder. Then, after making their way between the squadrons of their own cavalry, they jump down from the chariots and engage on foot. In the meantime, their charioteers retire a short distance from the battle and place the chariots in such a position that their masters, if hard pressed by numbers, have an easy means of retreat to their own lines. Thus they combine the mobility of cavalry with the staying power of infantry, and by daily training and practice they attain such proficiency that even on a steep incline they are able to control the horses at full gallop and to check and turn them in a moment. They can run along the chariot pole, stand on the yoke, and get back into the chariot as quick as lightning. Cassivellaunus, using these mobile forces and avoiding a pitched battle with the Roman legions, escorted them on their inroad and cut off their foraging parties. Nonetheless, Caesar captured his first stronghold. The tribes began to make terms for themselves. A well-conceived plan for destroying Caesar's base on the Kentish shore was defeated. At this juncture, Cassivellaunus, by a prudence of policy equal to that of his tactics, negotiated a further surrender of hostages and a promise of tribute and submission, in return for which Caesar was again content to quit the island. In a dead calm, he set sail late in the evening and brought all the fleets safely to land at dawn. This time he proclaimed a conquest. Caesar had his triumph, and the British captives trod their dreary path at his tail through the streets of Rome. But for nearly 100 years, no invading army landed upon the island coasts. Little is known of Cassivellaunus, and we can only hope that later defenders of the island will be equally successful, and that their measures will be as well suited to the needs of the time. The impression remains of a prudent and skilful chief, whose qualities and achievements, but for the fact that they were displayed in an outlandish theatre, might well have ranked with those of Fabius Maximus Cunctator. Chapter 2. Subjugation. During the 100 years which followed Julius Caesar's invasion, the British islanders remained unmolested. The Belgic cities developed a life of their own, and the warrior tribes enjoyed amid their internecine feuds the comforting illusion that no one was likely to attack them again. However, their contacts with the mainland and with the civilization of the Roman Empire grew, and trade flourished in a wide range of commodities. Roman traders established themselves in many parts and carried back to Rome tales of the wealth and possibilities of Britannia if only a stable government were set up. In the year AD 41, the murder of the Emperor Caligula and a chapter of accidents brought his uncle, the clownish scholar Claudius, to the throne of the world. No one can suppose that any coherent will to conquest resided in the new ruler, but the policy of Rome was shaped by the officials of highly competent departments. It proceeded upon broad lines, and in its various aspects attracted a strong and growing measure of support from many sections of public opinion. Eminent senators aired their views, important commercial and financial interests were conciliated, and elegant society had a new topic for gossip. Thus, in this triumphant period, there were always available for a new emperor a number of desirable projects, well thought out beforehand and in harmony with the generally understood Roman system, any of which might catch the fancy of the latest wielder of supreme power. Hence we find emperors elevated by chance, whose unbridled and capricious passions were their only distinction, whose courts were debauched with lust and cruelty, who were themselves vicious or feeble-minded, who were pawns in the hands of their counselors or favorites, decreeing great campaigns and setting their seal upon long-lasting acts of salutary legislation. The advantages of conquering the recalcitrant island Britannia were paraded before the new monarch, and his interest was excited. He was attracted by the idea of gaining a military reputation. He gave orders that this dramatic and possibly lucrative enterprise should proceed. In the year 43, almost 100 years after Julius Caesar's evacuation, a powerful, well-organized Roman army of some 20,000 men was prepared for the subjugation of Britain. The soldiers were indignant at the thought of carrying on a campaign outside the limits of the known world. When the emperor's favorite freedman, Narcissus, attempted to address them, they felt the insult. The spectacle of a former slave called in to stand sponsor for their commander rallied them to their duty. They taunted Narcissus with his slave origin, with a mocking shout of, "Io Saturnalia!" For at the festival of Saturn, the slaves donned their master's dress and held festival. But nonetheless, they resolved to obey their chief's order. Their delay, however, had made their departure late in the season. They were sent over in 3 divisions in order that they should not be hindered in landing, as might happen to a single force. And in their voyage across, they first became discouraged because they were driven back in their course, and then plucked up courage because a flash of light rising in the east shot across to the west, the direction in which they were sailing. So they put into the island and found none to oppose them. For the Britons, as the result of their inquiries, had not expected that they would come, and had therefore not assembled beforehand. The internal situation favoured the invaders. Cunobelinus, Shakespeare's Cymbeline, had established an overlordship over the south-east of the island, with his capital at Colchester. But in his old age, dissensions had begun to impair his authority, and on his death, the kingdom was ruled jointly by his sons Caractacus and Togodumnus. They were not everywhere recognized, and they had no time to form a union of the tribal kingdom before the Roman commander, Plautius, and his legions arrived. The people of Kent fell back on the tactics of Cassivellaunus, and Plautius had much trouble in searching them out. But when he did find them, he first defeated Caractacus, and then his brother, somewhere in East Kent. Then, advancing along Caesar's old line of march, he came on a river he'd not heard of, the Medway. The barbarians thought that the Romans would not be able to cross without a bridge, and consequently bivouacked in rather careless fashion on the opposite bank. But the Roman general sent across a detachment of Germans, who were accustomed to swim easily in full armour across the most turbulent streams. These fell unexpectedly upon the enemy, but instead of shooting at the men, they disabled the horses that drew the chariots, and in the ensuing confusion, not even the enemy's mounted men could save themselves. Nevertheless, the Britons faced them on the second day, and were only broken by a flank attack, Vespasian, someday to be emperor himself, having discovered a ford higher up. This victory marred the stage management of the campaign. Plautius had won his battle too soon and in the wrong place. Something had to be done to show that the Emperor's presence was necessary to victory. So Claudius, who'd been waiting on events in France, crossed the seas bringing substantial reinforcements, including a number of elephants. A battle was procured, and the Romans won. Claudius returned to Rome to receive from the Senate the title of Britannicus and permission to celebrate a triumph. But the British war continued. The Britons would not come to close quarters with the Romans, but took refuge in the swamps and the forests, hoping to wear out the invaders so that, as in the days of Julius Caesar, they should sail back with nothing accomplished. Caractacus escaped to the Welsh border, and, rousing its tribes, maintained an indomitable resistance for more than 6 years. It was not until A.D. 50 that he was finally defeated by a new general, Ostorius, the successor of Plautius, who reduced to submission the whole of the more settled regions from the Wash to the Severn. Caractacus, escaping from the ruin of his forces in the west, sought to raise the Brigantes in the north. Their queen, however, handed him over to the Romans. "The fame of the British prince," writes Suetonius, "had by this time spread over the provinces of Gaul and Italy, and upon his arrival in the Roman capital the people flocked from all quarters to behold him. The ceremonial of his entrance was conducted with great solemnity. On a plain adjoining the Roman camp, the Praetorian troops were drawn up in martial array. The emperor and his court took their station in front of the lines, and behind them was ranged the whole body of the people. The procession commenced with the different trophies which had been taken from the Britons during the progress of the war. Next followed the brothers of the vanquished prince, with his wife and daughter in chains, expressing by their supplicating looks and gestures the fears with which they were actuated. But not so Caractacus himself. With a manly gait and an undaunted countenance, he marched up to the tribunal where the emperor was seated, and addressed him in the following terms. "If, to my high birth and distinguished rank, I had added the virtues of moderation, Rome had beheld me rather as a friend than a captive, and you would not have rejected an alliance with a prince descended from illustrious ancestors and governing many nations. The reverse of my fortune to you is glorious, and to me humiliating. I had arms, and men, and horses. I possessed extraordinary riches. And can it be any wonder that I was unwilling to lose them? Because Rome aspires to universal dominion, must men therefore implicitly resign themselves to subjection? I opposed for a long time the progress of your arms, and had I acted otherwise, would either you have had the glory of conquest, or I of a brave resistance? I am now in your power. If you are determined to take revenge, my fate will soon be forgotten, and you will derive no honour from the transaction. Preserve my life, and I shall remain to the latest ages a monument of your clemency." Immediately upon this speech,